It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
growers or employers of farm workers prefer the foreign labor for many reasons. For example, the foreign labor are dependent on the growers. When they come here, they cannot change jobs. So they tend to accept any sort of working and living conditions, even if they are substandard, because they don't have any other choice. By coming here, many of them incur in debt because they have to upfront expenses to pay for the visa, to pay for the travel to the United States. And in that way, they kind of feel trapped in a situation which sometimes it's not so good, but they tend to be more accepting of not optimal living and working conditions in the U.S., while U.S. citizens and residents will have the option to change jobs.
Christian Quiroz, director of the Virginia Farm Workers Program, describes the lives of farm workers in Virginia and the laws which protect and sometimes fail to protect them. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll tell you why the George Zimmerman not guilty verdict really is rooted in the problem of segregated neighborhoods. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 211, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and online at www.rir.org and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. George Zimmerman will not be the last vigilante to stand trial for the killing of an unarmed black teen. While it is convenient to blame the law, such as Make My Day or Stand Your Ground laws, such as Florida's, for failing to protect Trayvon Martin and other innocent young black men assumed to be suspicious, the root of this problem lies much deeper in America's maintenance of all-white neighborhoods. According to Janine Bell, a professor at Indiana University School of Law, more than 40 years after the passage of the Fair Housing Act, most housing in America remains segregated along racial lines. Census data from 2010 show that the average white person lives in a neighborhood that is 75% white. The average black person lives in a neighborhood that is only 35% white. Income and the size of one's housing allowance do not help most blacks escape segregation. Research also shows that minority neighborhoods lack the better schools and other amenities. The causes of housing segregation are varied. To be sure, some blacks may elect to avoid living in majority white neighborhoods. One reason is violence. Zimmerman is not the first armed individual seeking to protect his neighborhood from someone he deemed an outsider. Professor Bell's research has chronicled hundreds of incidents between 1990 and 2010 in which whites targeted minorities who moved into their neighborhood. Blacks living in majority white neighborhoods also face problems when inviting friends or relatives to visit. Martin's killing highlights the vulnerability of these guests to white stereotyping that sees these black visitors, who dare to cross the color line, as potential criminals. It is not disputed that Zimmerman initiated the encounter with Martin when he deemed the young man suspicious. It was only Martin's blackness, not his size, not his age, not his behavior, that sparked Zimmerman's initial concern. Zimmerman argued that he feared for his life when his supposed assailant was an unarmed teenager he outweighed by more than 100 pounds. Too many Americans are harmed by what Professor Bell terms the integration nightmare. They assume that good and safe neighborhoods are neighborhoods without black people in them. Thus, they see the arrival of black neighbors as disruptive. They see more diversity as threatening. Nothing can bring back Martin, but perhaps as a society, we can learn from the circumstances of his death. To prevent killings and other violence, we need to think differently. In particular, we need to recognize the value of racial and ethnic diversity in America's neighborhoods. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Central Virginia Legal Aid Society office in Charlottesville, and we're speaking with Christiane Quiroz. She is the director of the Virginia Farm Workers Program, and that is what we will be talking about today, farm workers. Welcome back to the show, Christiane.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Now, the reason I wanted to talk to you today about farm workers, of course, has something to do with the immigration bills that are slowly making their way through Congress, and many of those would affect farm workers both nationally and in Virginia, and it has shed new light upon farm workers in the country and in Virginia, both the documented and undocumented. And a lot of people would be surprised to know just where their food comes from, who picks their food, and how many of those folks have questionable legal status. So could you give us some background? How many farm workers are there in the country, and where are they from? What's their status?
Well, we have millions of farm workers in the country, and the majority of them are currently undocumented. Virginia is not one of the states that receive more farm workers. The states are California, Florida, where the number of farm workers are really high. In Virginia, we have visited on a yearly basis thousands of farm workers. Our program focuses on documented farm workers, the ones that come here with a H-2A visa, which is a visa specifically to work seasonally in agriculture. But we do know that there are several undocumented farm workers working in Virginia.
And it might surprise people to know that there are documented H-2A visa farm workers in Virginia. Can you tell us a little more about them? Where are they located? What do they do? I know that the Virginia Farm Worker Program covers the entire state, so you can give us a pretty broad reach for where these workers are and what they do.
That's correct. They move in here to Virginia according to seasonality of crops. So usually the earliest arrivals are workers that come from Mexico predominantly to work in vineyards. Then we have the folks that come to work as early as April, come to work with vegetable and fruit crops. And then as the summer progresses, we have a higher number of, again, mostly predominantly farm workers from Mexico that come to work in tobacco. And then from mid-August to mid-October, we have folks that come from Jamaica and Haiti to work in apple crops in the Winchester area. And later in the year, we have folks that come to work in pine trees in the Southwest Virginia region. We also have a large number of farm workers that work in the Eastern Shore, mostly tomato pickers. And this is also mostly during the summer months.
And along the Eastern Shore in Chesapeake Bay, are there also hard to call them farm workers, but are there migrant workers who come in on these visas who do fishing and crabbing and oystering and that type of thing?
Yes, we also have that. And they might come under H-2A visa or under H-2B visa. H-2B visa is for non-agricultural activities, but since they are limited in numbers, sometimes the employers try to bring people under the H-2A visa to do these activities.
And what's the process for bringing these workers in here? I understand that one of the requirements is that they cannot get U.S. workers, citizens, to actually do these jobs. Could you describe that process a bit more?
Yes. In fact, U.S. workers should receive priority in hiring for these jobs. But what we see is, unfortunately, many times discriminatory practices that keep U.S. workers out of these jobs, just beginning by, you know, discriminatory practices at the time of application for the jobs, and all posing tougher requirements that are sometimes imposed to foreign workers. And in other instances, you have this training period, which is very short, a couple of days, where people are supposed to adapt to a very physically demanding job. So, and many times people are fired after these 3 initial days of training, U.S. workers, I mean, and replaced by H-2A workers, the foreign workers that come from abroad.
So if I understand, one of the reasons that the H-2A workers get the job is they've been trained, they know how to do it, as opposed to the U.S. workers who have never done farm work and don't realize just how physically demanding and how technically difficult it is.
That is true, although sometimes folks that live in rural areas, they do know the work, and even so, due to a series of circumstances, growers or employers of farm workers prefer the foreign labor for many reasons. For example, the foreign labor are dependent on the growers. When they come here, they cannot change jobs, so they tend to accept any sort of working and living conditions, even if they are substandard, because they don't have any other choice. By coming here, many of them incur in debt because they have to upfront expenses to pay for the visa, to pay for the travel to the United States. And in that way, they kind of feel trapped in a situation which sometimes it's not so good, but they tend to be more accepting of not optimal living and working conditions in the U.S., while U.S. citizens and residents will have the option to change jobs.
And we'll talk about those working and living conditions in a moment, but just again, by way of background, when the foreign workers do come in to do one of these jobs, whether it's tomato picking, tobacco, apple picking, how long a period of time are we talking about them being employed at that job?
It's seasonal, so it depends very much on the crop seasonability, but usually according to the H-2A program laws, they should stay here no longer than 9 months.
So what are the working conditions like? You go to the camps. Tell us what you see.
We see farm workers that, you know, might not take necessary breaks, especially during the summer, to drink water or to rest on a shade because they are afraid that this will displease the grower, so they have to keep a certain pace. So they are, I would say, in a certain way required to keep a certain pace and a certain productivity. So what we see is folks kind of risking their lives, not taking water breaks or rest breaks. And in the temperatures that we are facing during the summer, we usually do, can be pretty dangerous. So this is one of the things that bothers us a lot, to see people not being safe when they work. There are other things like exposure to pesticide. Farm work is a very dangerous occupation, one of the most dangerous in the country. So we see a lot of accidents happening, and these folks have to rely on their employers to seek health care immediately in order to continue being productive workers.
So what health and safety protections, if any, are there? Are the growers, for example, required to provide so many bathrooms per worker or so much water per worker per day? And are there limits on the number of hours per day that the workers can be required to be out on the in the field? And are there regulations about pesticide application and how soon the workers can go back in after the application? Are there protections here?
There are protections, but the problem is enforcement of these protections are problematic. We do not have enough staff. The Department of Labor doesn't have enough staff to keep compliance high. So what we see is there is not much incentive for compliance, because if a grower is not complying and is having an advantage of another grower that's complying with the regulations, there's no incentive for everybody to comply. Or if they see that the others are getting away with it, which is unfortunately more common than we would like due to the lack of enforcement, then you're not going to see a lot of compliance going on.
Would it be fair to say that if you see some locally grown produce at an absurdly low price, that there's some likelihood that that's coming from a grower who is doing as you describe, really not complying with the protections for workers and trying to undercut the competitors to offer a cheaper priced product to the public?
That's an excellent point, Marty. But unfortunately, even high priced produce, there is no guarantee that grower is following the rules. But the thing is this, you're absolutely right about this. If essential that this workforce be recognized and be paid decent wages. So this is problematic, because while we have huge competition for the prices, to lower the prices, if we have those workers receiving better wages, the difference in price that has, there is an agreement that was worked out in Florida about this, the difference will be less than 20 cents to make a difference in the lives of the farm workers and provide them with living wages. So I believe that the consumers in the United States would be more than willing to pay a little bit more, or even better, the companies can really afford to pay those cents more for produce in order for us to provide more justice in the fields.
And give us an idea, how much are farm workers actually paid? What are their wages?
Well, the many farm workers make minimum wages, and in many cases, what's very problematic, because as you know, national minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but what's really problematic is that what end up happening is that there are wage theft. That's a reality out there in the field. So farm workers, sometimes they are not paid for time periods where they are waiting for the leaves or the plants to dry up. So they're there sitting in the field waiting, and that time waiting is not paid. Or when farm workers are traveling from fields to fields, they might not be paid for that traveling time. And there are other circumstances where their hours might not be recorded properly, and therefore they might not be receiving. So even though the majority of farm workers are paid minimum wage, sometimes they actually are not paid the minimum wage because of productivity requirements. For example, this is another point where you are required, you are promised $7.25 an hour, but then in fact, when you divide the amount that they receive for the productivity that they have performed, divided by the hours that they have worked, then their wages are depressed. They're not being actually paid the minimum wage. So this is another huge problem.
And it's my understanding that those practices you describe, not paying them when they're waiting for the leaves to dry or going from field to field, those are illegal, because it's not like the farm worker can just go and do some other job and get paid during that time. They're essentially trapped there.
Absolutely. They are at the disposal of their employers, and that should be time compensable.
What about the housing conditions? Obviously, these are migrant transitory workers. They have no permanent place of abode, so they have to rely on, I imagine in most cases, the growers to provide them housing. Are the growers, in fact, required to provide them housing, and are there standards regulating that?
Yes, so the H-2A workers, they can come here, and the growers are supposed to provide them housing, and they and most of the times they do. But the conditions of the housing many times are substandard. Good houses are there, but the majority of them are trailers, and you can notice that the upkeep is not that great. They're usually small for the number of workers that are housed there, and they're supposed to be inspected before occupation. But sometimes the inspection time and the time that the trailer or migrant camp is actually occupied by the workers, by the time the workers get here, something changed in that housing, and then it's very difficult to get it fixed after the workers are here. The other problem is what I was saying before. Compliance with regulations is a problem because we simply don't have enough people. So there are not enough people to perform inspections or go back to the camp to see if things are really okay after occupation. So those are the problems they're facing in regards to housing, and yeah, it's serious.
And what about healthcare? You mentioned that farm work is a very dangerous job, that there are a lot of job-related injuries that occur in the fields. How do these migrant workers get any type of healthcare, especially if they're injured?
When they are injured, the H-2A workers have in their contracts workers' compensation insurance. They have that right, but again, the incentive that the growers have to take a worker out of work, it's not very high. So we try to inform farm workers about their rights when an accident occurs, what they can do, what their contract provides to them, what type of protections, what they are entitled to. And that is to be seen by a doctor immediately and to have to receive treatment for the injury and to have the right, if the doctor says so, to not to work during that period where they have to recuperate from the injury. The insurance company is supposed to pay for the treatment and a percentage of the wages while the workers are not working. But again, there's a lot of pressure for the workers to return to work as soon as possible. And with that, many times we see re-injuries occurring. And that's pretty crippling for this workforce that depends essentially in their physical health to perform this job. So that's another point of a very serious concern, because it's a dangerous occupation and there's not much incentive for these guys to receive all medical care and follow up that they need. Besides, when the season ends, usually they return to their home countries, and it's very unlikely that treatment will continue there. So several of these folks can never more return to perform farm work, and that's what they do for a living. So it's very concerning.
And if people want to learn more about farm workers and the working and living conditions that you described, what would be a good source for that?
I think that the DOL webpage will be one where you can see the regulations that apply to H-2A workers and other farm workers in the country. You can go, the South Department Law Center has published several reports on farm workers' conditions in the United States, and you can have a very accurate view of what goes on in the country. There are several other publications, and if people want to get in touch with me to obtain any of these, they can call me at my office number, which is 434-327-1442, or they can email me. My email is my first name. It's in our webpage, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. If you go to the Virginia Farm Workers Program link, you will see my email, but it's my first name, Christiane, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N-N-E, at C-V-L-A-S.org.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Christiane Quiroz, the director of the Virginia Farm Workers Program, about the living and working conditions of farm workers in Virginia and how the reality is not always what is supposed to be and protected by law. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Maury.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The minimum wage of $7.25 per hour applies to most employees, even if part of your pay comes from tips. Join us next week when private attorney Joanne Suez from the law firm of Marks & Harrison explains the Fair Labor Standards Act and how its minimum wage and overtime provisions apply to tipped employees in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on December 21, 2011. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.